her that life is not always so serious, so formal, so complicated. They are a reminder, too, that one is not all things to all people. They all have pet names. Ashima's pet name is Monu. Ashok's is Mitu. And even as adults, these are the names by which they are known in their respective families, the names by which they are adored and scolded and missed and loved. Every pet name is paired with a good name, a palanam, for identification in the outside world. Consequently, good names appear on envelopes, on diplomas, in telephone directories, and in all other public places. For this reason, letters from Ashima's mother say Ashima on the outside, Monu on the inside. Good names tend to represent dignified and enlightened qualities. Ashima means she who is limitless without borders. Ashok, the name of an emperor, means he who transcends grief. Pet names have no such aspirations. Pet names are never recorded officially, only uttered and remembered. Unlike good names, pet names are frequently meaningless, deliberately silly, ironic, even onomatopoetic. Often in one's infancy, one answers unwittingly to dozens of pet names, until one eventually sticks. And so, at one point, when the baby screws up his rosy, wrinkled face and regards his small circle of admirers, Mr. Nandi leans over and calls the baby Buro, the Bengali word for old man. "What's his name? Buro?" Patty inquires brightly, bearing another tray of baked chicken for Ashima. Ashok lifts the lid and polishes off the chicken. Ashima is now officially referred to by the maternity nurses as the Jello and Ice Cream Lady. "No, no, that is not a name," Ashima explains. "We haven't chosen. My grandmother is choosing." Patty nods. "Will she be here soon?" Ashima laughs, her first genuine laugh after giving birth. The thought of her grandmother, born in the previous century, a shrunken woman in widow's white and with tawny skin that refuses to wrinkle, boarding a plane and flying to Cambridge, is inconceivable to her. A thought that, no matter how welcome, how desirable, feels entirely impossible, absurd. "No, but a letter will." That evening, Ashok goes home to the apartment, checks for the letter. 3 days come and go. Ashima is shown by the nursing staff how to change diapers and how to clean the umbilical stub. She is given hot, salt water baths to soothe her bruises and stitches. She is given a list of pediatricians and countless brochures on breastfeeding and bonding and immunizing and samples of baby shampoos and Q-tips and creams. The fourth day, there is good news and bad news. The good news is that Ashima and the baby are to be discharged the following morning. The bad news is they are told by Mr. Wilcox, compiler of hospital birth certificates, that they must choose a name for their son. For they learn in America, a baby cannot be released from the hospital without a birth certificate, and that a birth certificate needs a name. "But sir," Ashima protests, "we can't possibly name him ourselves." Mr. Wilcox, slight, bald, unamused, glances at the couple, both visibly distressed, then glances at the nameless child. "I see," he says. "The reason being?" "We are waiting for a letter," Ashok says, explaining the situation in detail.
"I see," Mr. Wilcox says again. "That is unfortunate. I'm afraid your only alternative is to have the certificate read Baby Boy Ganguly. You will, of course, be required to amend the permanent record when a name is decided upon."
Ashima looks at Ashok expectantly. "Is that what we should do?"
"I don't recommend it," Mr. Wilcox says. "You will have to appear before a judge, pay a fee. The red tape is endless."
"Oh dear," Ashok says. Mr. Wilcox nods, and silence ensues.
"Don't you have any backups?" he asks.
Ashima frowns.
"What does it mean, backup?"
"Well, something in reserve, in case you didn't like what your grandmother has chosen." Ashima and Ashok shake their heads.
It has never occurred to either of them to question Ashima's grandmother's selection, to disregard an elder's wishes in such a way.
You can always name him after yourself, or one of your ancestors, Mr. Wilcox suggests, admitting that he is actually Howard Wilcox III.
It's a fine tradition. The kings of France and England did it, he adds.
But this isn't possible, Ashima and Ashok think to themselves. This tradition doesn't exist for Bengalis. Naming a son after father or grandfather, a daughter after mother or grandmother, this sign of respect in America and Europe, this symbol of heritage and lineage, would be ridiculed in India. Within Bengali families, individual names are sacred, inviolable. They are not meant to be inherited or shared.
Then what about naming him after another person? Someone you greatly admire, Mr. Wilcox says, his eyebrows raised hopefully.
He sighs. Think about it. I'll be back in a few hours, he tells him, exiting the room.
The door shuts, which is when, with a slight quiver of recognition, as if he'd known it all along, the perfect pet name for his son occurs to Ashok. He remembers the page crumpled tightly in his fingers, the sudden shock of the lantern's glare in his eyes. But for the first time, he thinks of that moment not with terror, but with gratitude.
Hello, Gogol, he whispers, leaning over his son's haughty face, his tightly bundled body.
Gogol, he repeats, satisfied. The baby turns his head with an expression of extreme consternation and yawns. Ashima approves, aware that the name stands not only for her son's life, but her husband's. She knows the story of the accident, a story she first heard with polite newlywed sympathy, but the thought of which now especially, makes her blood go cold. There are nights when she has been woken by her husband's muffled screams. Times they have ridden the subway together and the rhythm of the wheels on the tracks makes him suddenly pensive, aloof. She has never read any Gogol herself, but she is willing to place him on a shelf in her mind along with Tennyson and Wordsworth. Besides, it's only a pet name, not to be taken seriously, simply something to put on the certificate for now to release him from the hospital. When Mr. Wilcox returns with his typewriter, Ashok spells out the name. Thus Gogol Ganguly is registered in the hospital's files.
Goodbye, Gogol, Patty says, planting a quiet kiss on his shoulder, and to Ashima, dressed once again in her wrinkled silk sari, good luck.
A first photograph, somewhat overexposed, is taken by Dr. Gupta that broiling hot late summer's day. Gogol, an indistinct blanketed mass, reposing in his weary mother's arms. She stands on the steps of the hospital staring at the camera, her eyes squinting into the sun. Her husband looks on from one side, his wife's suitcase in his hand, smiling with his head lowered. Gogol enters the world, his father will eventually write on the back in Bengali letters. Gogol's first home is a fully furnished apartment 10 minutes by foot to Harvard, 20 to MIT. The apartment is on the first floor of a 3-story house, covered with salmon-colored shingles, surrounded by a waist-high chain-link fence. The gray of the roof, the gray of cigarette ashes, matches the pavement of the sidewalk and the street. A row of cars parked at meters perpetually lines one side of the curb. At the corner of the block, there is a small used bookstore, which one enters by going down 3 steps from the sidewalk, and across from it, a musty shop that sells the newspaper and cigarettes and eggs, and where, to Ashima's mild disgust, a furry black cat is permitted to sit as it pleases on the shelves. Other than these small businesses, there are more shingled houses, the same shape and size, and in the same state of mild decrepitude, painted mint or lilac or powder blue. This is the house Ashok had brought Ashima to 18 months ago, late one February night after her arrival at Logan Airport. In the dark, through the windows of the taxi, wide awake from jet lag, she could barely make out a thing, apart from heaps of broken snow glowing like shattered bluish-white bricks on the ground. It wasn't until morning, stepping briefly outside wearing a pair of Ashok's socks under her thin-soled slippers,
the frigid New England chill piercing her inner ears and jaw, that she'd had her first real glimpse of America. Leafless trees with ice-covered branches. Dog urine and excrement embedded in the snowbanks. Not a soul on the street. The apartment consists of three rooms all in a row without a corridor. There is a living room at the front with a three-sided window overlooking the street, a pass-through bedroom in the middle, a kitchen at the back. It is not at all what she had expected. Not at all like the houses in Gone with the Wind or The Seven-Year Itch, movies she had seen with her brother and cousins at the Lighthouse and the Metro. The apartment is drafty during winter, and in summer, intolerably hot. The thick glass window panes are covered by dreary dark brown curtains. There are even roaches in the bathroom, emerging at night from the cracks in the tiles. But she has complained of none of this. She has kept her disappointment to herself, not wanting to offend Ashok or worry her parents. Instead, she writes, in her letters home, of the powerful cooking gas that flares up at any time of day or night from four burners on the stove, and the hot tap water fierce enough to scald her skin, and the cold water safe enough to drink. The top two floors of the house are occupied by their landlords, the Montgomerys, a Harvard sociology professor and his wife. The Montgomerys have two children, both girls, Amber and Clover, aged 7 and 9, whose waist-length hair is never braided, and who play on warm days for hours on a tire swing rigged to the only tree in the backyard. The professor, who has told Ashima and Ashok to call him Alan, not Professor Montgomery, as they had at first addressed him, has a wiry, rust-colored beard that makes him look much older than he actually is. They see him walking to Harvard Yard in a pair of threadbare trousers, a fringed suede jacket, and rubber flip-flops. "Rickshaw drivers dress better than professors here," Ashok, who still attends meetings with his advisor in a jacket and tie, thinks frequently to himself. The Montgomerys have a dull green Volkswagen van covered with stickers. "Question authority. Give a damn. Ban the bra. Peace." They have a washing machine in the basement which Ashok and Ashima are permitted to share, a television in their living room which Ashok and Ashima can hear clearly through the ceiling. It had been through the ceiling one night in April when Ashok and Ashima were eating their dinner that they'd heard about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and just recently of Senator Robert Kennedy. Sometimes Ashima and Alan's wife Judy stand side by side in the yard, clipping clothes to the line. Judy always wears blue jeans, torn up into shorts once summer comes, and a necklace of small seashells around her throat. A red cotton scarf over her stringy yellow hair, the same texture and shade as her daughter's, is always tied at the back of her neck. She works for a women's health collective in Somerville a few days a week. When she learned of Ashima's pregnancy, she approved of Ashima's decision to breastfeed, but had been disappointed to learn that Ashima was going to put herself in the hands of the medical establishment for her child's delivery. Judy's daughters were born at home, with the help of midwives at the collective. Some nights, Judy and Alan go out, leaving Amber and Clover unsupervised at home. Only once, when Clover had a cold, did they ask Ashima if she could check in on them. Ashima remembers their apartment with abiding horror. Just beyond the ceiling, yet so different from her own, piles everywhere. Piles of books and papers, piles of dirty plates on the kitchen counter, ashtrays the size of serving platters heaped with crushed-out cigarettes. The girls slept together on a bed piled with clothes. Sitting momentarily on the edge of Alan and Judy's mattress, she had cried out, falling clumsily backward, startled to discover that it was filled with water. Instead of cereal and tea bags, there are whiskey and wine bottles on top of the refrigerator, most of them nearly empty. Just standing there had made Ashima feel drunk. They arrive home from the hospital courtesy of Dr. Gupta, who owns a car, and sit in the sweltering living room in front of their only box fan. Suddenly, a family. Instead of a couch, they have six chairs, all of them three-legged, with oval wooden backs and black triangular cushions. To her surprise, finding herself once again in the gloomy three-room apartment, Ashima misses the hustle-bustle of the hospital, and Patty, and the jello and ice cream brought at regular intervals to her side. As she walks slowly through the rooms, it irks her that there are dirty dishes stacked in the kitchen, that the bed has not been made. Until now, Ashima has accepted that there is no one to sweep the floor, or do the dishes, or wash clothes, or shop for groceries, or prepare a meal on the day she is tired or homesick or cross. She has accepted that the very lack of such amenities is the American way. But now, with a baby crying in her arms, her breasts swollen with milk, her body coated with sweat, her groin still so sore she can scarcely sit, it is all suddenly unbearable.
"I can't do this," she tells Ashok when he brings her a cup of tea, the only thing he can think to do for her, the last thing she feels like drinking.
"In a few days you'll get the hang of it," he says, hoping to encourage her, unsure of what else to do. He sets the cup beside her on the flaking windowsill.
"I think he's falling asleep again," he adds,
looking at Goggle, whose cheeks are working methodically at his wife's breast.
"I won't," she insists thickly, looking neither at the baby nor at him.
She pulls back a bit of the curtain, then lets it fall.
"Not here, not like this."
"What are you saying, Ashima?"
"I'm saying hurry up and finish your degree."
And then, impulsively, admitting it for the first time,
"I'm saying I don't want to raise Goggle alone in this country. It's not right. I want to go back."
He looks at Ashima, her face leaner, the features sharper than they had been at their wedding, aware that her life in Cambridge, as his wife, has already taken a toll. On more than one occasion he has come home from the university to find her morose, in bed, rereading her parents' letters. Early mornings, when he senses that she is quietly crying, he puts an arm around her, but can think of nothing to say, feeling that it is his fault, for marrying her, for bringing her here. He remembers suddenly about Ghosh, his companion on the train, who had returned from England for his wife's sake.
"It is my greatest regret coming back,"
Ghosh had confessed to Ashok, mere hours before he was killed. A soft knock on the door interrupts him. Alan and Judy and Amber and Clover all there to see the baby. Judy holds a dish covered with a checkered cloth in her hands, says she's made a broccoli quiche. Alan sets down a garbage bag full of Amber and Clover's old baby clothes, uncorks a bottle of cold champagne. The foaming liquid splashes onto the floor, is poured into mugs. They raise their mugs to Goggle, Ashima and Ashok, only pretending to take sips. Amber and Clover flank Ashima at either side, both delighted when Goggle wraps a hand around each of their fingers. Judy scoops the baby out of Ashima's lap.
"Hello, handsome," she coos. "Oh, Alan," she says, "let's have another one of these."
Alan offers to bring up the girl's crib from the basement, and together he and Ashok assemble it in the space next to Ashima and Ashok's bed. Ashok goes out to the corner store, and a box of disposable diapers replaces the framed black-and-white pictures of Ashima's family on the dressing table.
20 minutes at 3:50 for the quiche," Judy says to Ashima.
"Holler if you need anything," Alan adds before they disappear. 3 days later, Ashok is back at MIT. Alan is back at Harvard. Amber and Clover are back at school. Judy is at work at the collective, as usual. And Ashima, on her own with Goggle for the first time in the silent house, suffering from a sleep deprivation far worse than the worst of her jet lag, sits by the three-sided window in the living room on one of the triangular chairs and cries the whole day. She cries as she feeds him, as she pats him to sleep, and as he cries between sleeping and feeding. She cries after the mailman's visit because there are no letters from Calcutta. She cries when she calls Ashok at his department and he does not answer. One day she cries when she goes to the kitchen to make dinner and discovers that they've run out of rice. She goes upstairs and knocks on Alan and Judy's door. "Help yourself," Judy says. But the rice in Judy's canister is brown. To be polite, Ashima takes a cup, but downstairs she throws it away. She calls Ashok at his department to ask him to pick up rice on his way home. This time, when there's no answer, she gets up, washes her face, and combs her hair. She changes and dresses Goggle and puts him into the navy blue, white-wheeled pram inherited from Alan and Judy. For the first time, she pushes him through the balmy streets of Cambridge to Purity Supreme to buy a bag of white, long-grain rice. The errand takes longer than usual, for now she is repeatedly stopped on the street and in the aisles of the supermarket by perfect strangers, all Americans, suddenly taking notice of her, smiling, congratulating her for what she's done. They look curiously, appreciatively into the pram. "How old?" they ask. "Boy or girl? What's his name?" She begins to pride herself on doing it alone, in devising a routine. Like Ashok, busy with his teaching and research and dissertation 7 days a week, she too now has something to occupy her fully, to demand her utmost devotion, her last ounce of strength. Before Goggle's birth, her days had followed no visible pattern. She would spend hours in the apartment, napping, sulking, rereading her same 5 Bengali novels on the bed. But now the days that had once dragged rush all too quickly toward evening. Those same hours are consumed with Goggle, pacing the 3 rooms of the apartment with him in her arms. Now she wakes at 6, pulling Goggle out of the crib for his first feeding, and then for half an hour she and Ashok lie with the baby in bed between them, admiring the tiny person they've produced. Between 11 and 1, while Goggle sleeps, she gets dinner out of the way, a habit she will maintain for decades to come. Every afternoon, she takes him out, wandering up and down the streets to pick up this or that, or to sit in Harvard Yard, sometimes meeting up with Ashok on a bench on the MIT campus, bringing him some homemade samosas and a fresh thermos of tea. At times, staring at the baby, she sees pieces of her family in his face, her mother's glossy eyes, her father's slim lips, her brother's lopsided smile. She discovers a yarn store and begins to knit for the coming winter, making Goggle sweaters, blankets, mittens, and caps. Every few days, she gives Goggle a bath in the porcelain sink in the kitchen. Every week, she carefully clips the nails of his 10 fingers and toes. When she takes him in his pram for his immunizations at the pediatrician's, she stands outside the room and plugs her ears. One day, Ashok arrives home with an Instamatic camera to take pictures of the baby. And when Goggle is napping, she pastes the square, white-bordered prints behind plastic sheets in an album, captions written on pieces of masking tape. To put him to sleep, she sings him the Bengali songs her mother had sung to her. She drinks in the sweet, milky fragrance of his skin, the buttery scent of his breath. One day, she lifts him high over her head, smiling at him with her mouth open, and a quick stream of undigested milk from his last feeding rises from his throat and pours into her own. For the rest of her life, she will recall the shock of that warm, sour liquid, a taste that leaves her unable to swallow another thing for the rest of the day. Letters arrive from her parents, from her husband's parents, from aunts and uncles and cousins and friends, from everyone, it seems, but Ashima's grandmother. The letters are filled with every possible blessing and good wish, composed in an alphabet they have seen all around them for most of their lives, on billboards and newspapers and awnings, but which they see now only in these precious pale blue missives. Sometimes 2 letters arrive in a single week. 1 week there are 3. As always, Ashima keeps her ear trained between the hours of 12 and 2 for the sound of the postman's footsteps on the porch, followed by the soft click of the mail slot in the door. The margins of her parents' letters, always a block of her mother's hasty penmanship, followed by her father's flourishing elegant hand, are frequently decorated with drawings of animals done by Ashima's father, and Ashima tapes these on the wall over Goggle's crib. "We are dying to see him," her mother writes. "These are the most crucial months. Every hour there is a change. Remember it." Ashima writes back with careful descriptions of her son, reporting the circumstances of his first smile, the day he first rolls over, his first squeal of delight. She writes that they are saving money for a trip home the following December, after Goggle turns 1. She does not mention the pediatrician's concern about tropical diseases. A trip to India will require a whole new set of immunizations, he is warned. In November, Goggle develops a mild ear infection.
When Ashima and Ashok see their son's pet name typed on the label of a prescription for antibiotics, when they see it at the top of his immunization record, it doesn't look right. Pet names aren't meant to be made public in this way. But there is still no letter from Ashima's grandmother. They are forced to conclude that it is lost in the mail. Ashima decides to write to her grandmother explaining the situation, asking her to send a second letter with the names. The very next day, a letter arrives in Cambridge. Though it is from Ashima's father, no drawings for Goggle adorn the margins, no elephants or parrots or tigers. The letter is dated 3 weeks ago, and from it, they learn that Ashima's grandmother has had a stroke, that her right side is permanently paralyzed, her mind dim. She can no longer chew, barely swallows, remembers and recognizes little of her 80-odd years. "She is with us still, but to be honest, we have already lost her," her father has written. "Prepare yourself, Ashima. Perhaps you may not see her again." It is their first piece of bad news from home. Ashok barely knows Ashima's grandmother, only vaguely recalls touching her feet at his wedding. But Ashima is inconsolable for days. She sits at home with Goggle as the leaves turn brown and drop from the trees, as the days begin to grow quickly, mercilessly dark, thinking of the last time she saw her grandmother, her Dida, a few days before flying to Boston. Ashima had gone to visit her. For the occasion, her grandmother had entered the kitchen after over a decade's retirement to cook Ashima a light goat and potato stew. She had fed her sweets with her own hand. Unlike her parents and her other relatives, her grandmother had not admonished Ashima not to eat beef or wear skirts or cut off her hair or forget her family the moment she landed in Boston. Her grandmother had not been fearful of such signs of betrayal. She was the only person to predict, rightly, that Ashima would never change. Before leaving, Ashima had stood, her head lowered, under her late grandfather's portrait, asking him to bless her journey. Then she bent down to touch the dust of her Dida's feet to her head. "Dida, I'm coming," Ashima had said, for this was the phrase Bengalis always used in place of goodbye. "Enjoy it," her grandmother had bellowed in her thundering voice, helping Ashima to straighten. With trembling hands, her grandmother had pressed her thumbs to the tears streaming down Ashima's face, wiping them away. "Do what I will never do. It will all be for the best. Remember that. Now, go." As the baby grows, so too does their circle of Bengali acquaintances. Through the Nandis, now expecting a child of their own, Ashok and Ashima meet the Mitras, and through the Mitras, the Banerjees. More than once, pushing Goggle in his stroller, Ashima has been approached on the streets of Cambridge by young Bengali bachelors, shyly inquiring after her origins. Like Ashok, the bachelors fly back to Calcutta one by one, returning with wives. Every weekend, it seems, there's a new home to go to, a new couple or a young family to meet. They all come from Calcutta, and for this reason alone, they are friends. Most of them live within walking distance of one another in Cambridge. The husbands are teachers, researchers, doctors, engineers. The wives, homesick and bewildered, turn to Ashima for recipes and advice. And she tells them about the carp that's sold in Chinatown, that it's possible to make halwa from cream of wheat. The families drop by one another's homes on Sunday afternoons. They drink tea with sugar and evaporated milk and eat shrimp cutlets fried in saucepans. They sit in circles on the floor singing songs by Nazrul and Tagore, passing a thick yellow cloth-bound book of lyrics among them as Dilip Nandi plays the harmonium. They argue riotously over the films of Hrithik Ghatak versus those of Satyajit Ray, the CPIM versus a Congress party, North Calcutta versus South. For hours they argue about the politics of America, a country in which none of them is eligible to vote. By February, when Goggle is 6 months old, Ashima and Ashok know enough people to entertain on a proper scale. The occasion, Goggle's Annaprasan, his rice ceremony. There is no baptism for Bengali babies, no ritualistic naming in the eyes of God.
Instead, the first formal ceremony of their lives centers around the consumption of solid food. They ask Dilip Nandi to play the part of Ashima's brother, to hold the child and feed him rice, the Bengali staff of life, for the very first time. Gogol is dressed as an infant Bengali groom in a pale yellow pajama Punjabi from his grandmother in Calcutta. The fragrance of cumin seeds sent in a package along with the pajamas lingers in the weave. A headpiece that Ashima cut out of paper, decorated with pieces of aluminum foil, is tied around Gogol's head with string. He wears a thin 14-carat gold chain around his neck. His tiny forehead has been decorated with considerable struggle with sandalwood paste to form 6 miniature beige moons floating above his brows. His eyes have been darkened with a touch of coal. He fidgets in the lap of his honorary uncle, who sits on a bed cover on the floor, surrounded by guests in front and behind and beside him. The food is arranged in 10 separate bowls. Ashima regrets that the plate on which the rice is heaped is melamine, not silver or brass, or at the very least, stainless steel. The final bowl contains payesh, a warm rice pudding Ashima will prepare for him to eat on each of his birthdays as a child, as an adult even, alongside a slice of bakery cake. He is photographed by his father and friends, frowning, as he searches for his mother's face in the crowd. She is busy setting up the buffet. She wears a silvery sari, a wedding gift worn for the first time, the sleeves of her blouse reaching the crook of her elbow. His father wears a transparent white Punjabi top over bell-bottom trousers. Ashima sets out paper plates that have to be tripled to hold the weight of the biryani, the carp in yogurt sauce, the dal, the 6 different vegetable dishes she'd spent the past week preparing. The guests will eat standing or sitting cross-legged on the floor. They've invited Alan and Judy from upstairs, who look, as they always do, in jeans and thick sweaters because it is cold, leather sandals buckled over woolly socks. Judy eyes the buffet, bites into something that turns out to be a shrimp cutlet.
"I thought Indians were supposed to be vegetarian," she whispers to Alan.
Gogol's feeding begins. It's all just a touch, a gesture. No one expects the boy to eat anything more than a grain of rice here, a drop of dal there. It is all meant to introduce him to a lifetime of consumption, a meal to inaugurate the tens of thousands of unremembered meals to come. A handful of women ululate as the proceedings begin. A conch shell is repeatedly tapped and passed around, but no one in the room is able to get it to emit a sound. Blades of grass and a Pradeep's slim, steady flame are held to Gogol's head. The child is entranced, doesn't squirm or turn away, opens his mouth obediently for each and every course. He takes his payesh 3 times. Ashima's eyes fill with tears as Gogol's mouth eagerly invites the spoon. She can't help wishing her own brother were here to feed him, her own parents to bless him with their hands on his head. And then the grand finale, the moment they have all been waiting for. To predict his future path in life, Gogol is offered a plate holding a clump of cold Cambridge soil dug up from the backyard, a ballpoint pen, and a dollar bill to see if he will be a landowner, scholar, or businessman. Most children will grab at one of them, sometimes all of them, but Gogol touches nothing. He shows no interest in the plate, instead turning away, briefly burying his face in his honorary uncle's shoulder.
"Put the money in his hand," someone in the group calls out. "An American boy must be rich."
"No," his father protests.
"The pen, Gogol. Take the pen."
Gogol regards the plate doubtfully. Dozens of dark heads hover expectantly. The material of the Punjabi pajama set begins to scratch his skin.
"Go on, Gogol, take something,"
Dilip Nandi says, drawing the plate close. Gogol frowns, and his lower lip trembles. Only then, forced at 6 months to confront his destiny, does he begin to cry. Another August. Gogol is one, grabbing, walking a little, repeating words in 2 languages. He calls his mother Ma, his father Baba. If a person in the room says goggle, he turns his head and smiles. He sleeps through the night and between noon and three each day. He has 7 teeth. He constantly attempts to put the tiniest scraps of paper and lint and whatever else he finds on the floor into his mouth. Ashok and Ashima are planning their first trip to Calcutta in December during Ashok's winter break. The upcoming journey inspires them to try to come up with a good name for Goggle so they can submit his passport application. They turn to their Bengali friends for suggestions. Long evenings are devoted to considering this name or that, but nothing appeals to them. By then, they've given up on the letter from Ashima's grandmother. They've given up on her grandmother remembering the name. For Ashima's grandmother, they are told, cannot even remember Ashima. Still, there is time. The trip to Calcutta is 4 months away. Ashima regrets that they can't go earlier, in time for Durga Puja. But it will be years before Ashok is eligible for a sabbatical, and 3 weeks in December is all they can manage. It is like going home a few months after your Christmas, Ashima explains to Judy one day over the clothesline. Judy replies that she and Alan are Buddhists. At breakneck speed, Ashima knits sweater vests for her father, her father-in-law, her brother, her three favorite uncles. They are all the same, V-necked, pine-green yarn, knit 5, purl 2, on number 9 needles. The exception is her father's, done in a double seed stitch with 2 thick cables and buttons down the front. He prefers cardigans to pullovers, and she remembers to put in pockets for the deck of cards he always carries with him to play patience at a moment's notice. In addition to the sweater, she buys him 3 sable-haired paintbrushes from the Harvard Coop, sizes he's requested by mail. Though they are wildly expensive, more so than anything else she's ever bought in America, Ashok says nothing when he sees the bill. One day, Ashima goes shopping in downtown Boston, spending hours in the basement of Jordan Marsh as she pushes Goggle in his stroller, spending every last penny. She buys mismatched teaspoons, percale pillowcases, colored candles, soaps on ropes. In a drugstore, she buys a Timex watch for her father-in-law, big pens for her cousins, embroidery thread and thimbles for her mother and her aunts. On the train home, she is exhilarated, exhausted, nervous with anticipation of the trip. The train is crowded, and at first she stands, struggling to hang on to all the bags and the stroller and the overhead strap, until a young girl asks if she'd like to sit down. Ashima thanks her, sinking gratefully into the seat, pushing the bags protectively behind her legs. She is tempted to sleep as Goggle does. She leans her head against the window and closes her eyes and thinks of home. She pictures the black iron bars in the windows of her parents' flat and Goggle, in his American baby clothes and diapers, playing beneath the ceiling fan on her parents' 4-poster bed. She pictures her father missing a tooth, lost after a recent fall, her mother has written, on the stairs. She tries to imagine how it will feel when her grandmother doesn't recognize her. When she opens her eyes, she sees that the train is standing still. The doors open at her stop. She leaps up, her heart racing. "Excuse me, please," she says, pushing the stroller and herself through the tightly packed bodies. "Ma'am," someone says as she struggles past, about to step onto the platform. "Your things." The door of the subway clamps shut as she realizes her mistake, and the train rolls slowly away. She stands there watching until the rear car disappears into the tunnel, until she and Goggle are the only people remaining on the platform. She pushes the stroller back down Massachusetts Avenue, weeping freely, knowing that she can't possibly afford to go back and buy it all again. For the rest of the afternoon, she is furious with herself, humiliated at the prospect of arriving in Calcutta empty-handed, apart from the sweaters and the paintbrushes. But when Ashok comes home, he calls the MBTA lost and found. The following day, the bags are returned, not a teaspoon missing. Somehow, this small miracle causes Ashima to feel connected to Cambridge in a way she has not previously thought possible, affiliated with its exceptions as well as its rules. She has a story to tell at dinner parties. Friends listen, amazed at her luck. "Only in this country," Maya Nandi says. One night, not long after, they are fast asleep when the telephone rings. The sound rouses them instantly, their hearts hammering as if from the same frightening dream. Ashima knows, even before Ashok answers, that it's a call from India. A few months ago, her family had asked in a letter for the phone number in Cambridge, and she had sent it reluctantly in her reply, aware that it would only be a way for bad news to reach her. As Ashok sits up and takes the receiver, answering in a weary, weakened voice, Ashima prepares herself. She pushes down the crib railing to comfort Goggle, who has begun stirring as a result of the telephone's rings, and reviews the facts in her head. Her grandmother is in her 80s, bedridden, all but senile, unable to eat or talk. The last few months of her life, according to her parents' most recent letter, have been painful. For her grandmother, for those who know her. It was no way to live. She pictures her mother saying all this gently into the next-door neighbor's phone, standing in the neighbor's sitting room. Ashima prepares herself for the news, to accept the fact that Goggle will never meet his great-grandmother, the giver of his lost name. The room is unpleasantly cold. She picks up Goggle and gets back into bed under the blanket. She presses the baby to her body for strength, puts him to her breast. She thinks of the cream-colored cardigan bought with her grandmother in mind, sitting in a shopping bag in the closet. She hears Ashok speaking, saying soberly but loudly enough so that she fears he will wake Alan and Judy upstairs. "Yes, all right. I see. Don't worry. Yes, I will." For a while he is silent, listening. "They want to talk to you," he says to Ashima, briefly putting a hand to her shoulder. In the dark he hands her the phone, and after a moment's hesitation, he gets out of bed. She takes the phone in order to hear the news for herself, to console her mother. She can't help but wonder who will console her the day her own mother dies, if that news will also come to her in this way, in the middle of the night, wresting her from dreams. In spite of her dread, she feels a thrill. This will be the first time she's heard her mother's voice in nearly 3 years. The first time since her departure from Dum Dum Airport that she will be called Manu. Only it isn't her mother, but her brother Rana on the other end. His voice sounds small, threaded into a wire, barely recognizable through the holes of the receiver. Ashima's first question is, "What time is it there?" She has to repeat the question 3 times, shouting in order to be heard. Rana tells her it is lunchtime. "Are you still planning to visit in December?" he asks. She feels her chest ache, moved after all this time to hear her brother call her Didi, his older sister, a term he alone in the world is entitled to use. At the same time, she hears water running in the Cambridge kitchen, her husband opening a cupboard for a glass. "Of course we're coming," she says, unsettled when she hears her echo saying it faintly, less convincingly, once again. "How is Dida? Has anything else happened to her?" "Still alive," Rana says. "But still the same." Ashima rests back on her pillow, limp with relief. She would see her grandmother after all, even if for one last time. She kisses Goggle on the top of his head, presses her cheek to his. "Thank goodness. Put Ma on," she says, crossing her ankles. "Let me talk to her." "She's not at home now," Rana says after a static-filled pause. "And Baba?" A patch of silence follows before his voice returns. "Not here." "Oh." She remembers the time difference. Her father must be at work already at the desh offices, her mother at the market, a burlap bag in hand, buying vegetables and fish. "How is little Goggle?" Rana asks her. "Does he only speak English?" She laughs. "He doesn't speak much of anything at the moment." She begins to tell Rana that she is teaching Goggle to say Dida and Dadu and Mamu, to recognize his grandparents and his uncle from photographs. But another burst of static, longer this time, quiets her in mid-sentence. "Rana, can you hear me?"
I can't hear you, Didi, Rana says, his voice growing fainter. Can't hear. Let's speak later. Yes, she says. Later. See you soon. Very soon. Write to me.
She puts down the phone, invigorated by the sound of her brother's voice. An instant later, she is confused and somewhat irritated. Why had he gone to the trouble of calling, only to ask an obvious question? Why call while both her parents are out? Ashok returns from the kitchen, a glass of water in his hand. He sets down the water and switches on the small lamp by the side of the bed. I'm awake, Ashok says, though his voice is still small from fatigue.
Me too.
What about Google?
Asleep again.
She gets up and puts him back in the crib, drawing the blanket to his shoulders, then returns to bed, shivering.
I don't understand it, she says, shaking her head at the rumpled sheet. Why did Rana go to the trouble of calling just now? It's so expensive, it doesn't make sense.
She turns to look at Ashok.
What did he say to you exactly?
Ashok shakes his head from side to side, his profile lowered.
He told you something you're not telling me. Tell me, what did he say?
He continues to shake his head, and then he reaches across to her side of the bed and presses her hand so tightly that it is slightly painful. He presses her to the bed, lying on top of her, his face to one side, his body suddenly trembling. He holds her this way for so long that she begins to wonder if he is going to turn off the light and caress her. Instead, he tells her what Rana told him a few minutes ago, what Rana couldn't bear to tell his sister over the telephone himself, that her father died yesterday evening of a heart attack, playing patience on his bed. They leave for India 6 days later, 6 weeks before they'd planned. Alan and Judy, waking the next morning to Ashima's sobs, then hearing the news from Ashok, leave a vase filled with flowers by the door. In those 6 days, there is no time to think of a good name for Google. They get an express passport with Google Ganguly typed across the United States of America seal, Ashok signing on his son's behalf. The day before leaving, Ashima puts Google in his stroller, puts the sweater she'd knit for her father and the paintbrushes in a shopping bag, and walks to Harvard Square to the subway station.
Excuse me, she asks a gentleman on the street. I must get on the train.
The man helps her carry down the stroller and Ashima waits on the platform. When the train comes, she heads immediately back to Central Square. This time, she is wide awake. There are only a half dozen people in the car, their faces hidden behind the globe, or looking down at paperback books, or staring straight through her at nothing. As the train slows to a halt, she stands ready to disembark. She does not turn back to look at the shopping bag, left purposely beneath her seat.
Hey, the Indian lady forgot her stuff,
she hears as the doors shut. And as the train pulls away, she hears a fist pounding on glass, but she keeps walking, pushing Google along the platform. The following evening, they board a Pan Am flight to London, where after a 5-hour layover, they will board a second flight to Calcutta via Tehran and Bombay. On the runway in Boston, her seatbelt buckled, Ashima looks at her watch and calculates the Indian time on her fingers, but this time no image of her family comes to mind. She refuses to picture what she shall see soon enough, her mother's vermilion erased from her part, her brother's thick hair shaved from his head in mourning. The wheels begin to move, causing the enormous metal wings to flap gently up and down. Ashima looks at Ashok, who is double-checking to make sure their passports and green cards are in order. She watches him adjust his watch in anticipation of their arrival, the pale silver hands scissoring into place.
I don't want to go, she says, turning towards the dark oval window. I don't want to see them. I can't.
Ashok puts his hand over hers as the plane begins to gather speed, and then Boston tilts away and they ascend effortlessly over a blackened Atlantic. The wheels retract and the cabin shakes as they struggle upward through the first layer of clouds. Though Goggle's ears have been stuffed with cotton, he screams nevertheless in the arms of his grieving mother as they climb farther still.
as he flies for the first time in his life across the world. Chapter 3, 1971. The Gangulis have moved to a university town outside Boston. As far as they know, they are the only Bengali residents. The town has a historic district, a brief strip of colonial architecture visited by tourists on summer weekends. There is a white-steepled congregational church, a stone courthouse with an adjoining jail, a cupolaed public library, a wooden well from which Paul Revere is rumored to have drunk. In winter, tapers burn in the windows of homes after dark. Ashok has been hired as an assistant professor of electrical engineering at the university. In exchange for teaching 5 classes, he earns $16,000 a year. He is given his own office, with his name etched into a strip of black plastic by the door. He shares, along with the other members of his department, the services of an elderly secretary named Mrs. Jones, who often puts a plate of homemade banana bread by the coffee percolator in the staff room. Ashok suspects that Mrs. Jones, whose husband used to teach in the English department until his death, is about his own mother's age. Mrs. Jones leads a life that Ashok's mother would consider humiliating. Eating alone, driving herself to work in snow and sleet, seeing her children and grandchildren at most 3 or 4 times a year. The job is everything Ashok has ever dreamed of. He has always hoped to teach in a university rather than work for a corporation. What a thrill, he thinks, to stand lecturing before a room full of American students. What a sense of accomplishment it gives him to see his name printed under faculty in the university directory. What joy each time Mrs. Jones says to him, "Professor Ganguly, your wife is on the phone." From his fourth floor office, he has a sweeping view of the quadrangle, surrounded by vine-covered brick buildings, and on pleasant days he takes his lunch on a bench, listening to the melody of bells chiming from the campus clock tower. On Fridays, after he has taught his last class, he visits the library to read international newspapers on long wooden poles. He reads about U.S. planes bombing Viet Cong supply routes in Cambodia, Naxalites being murdered on the streets of Calcutta, India and Pakistan going to war. At times he wanders up to the library's sun-filled, unpopulated top floor, where all the literature is shelved. He browses in the aisles, gravitating most often towards his beloved Russians, where he is particularly comforted each time by his son's name stamped in golden letters on the spines of a row of red and green and blue hardbound books. For Ashima, migrating to the suburbs feels more drastic, more distressing than the move from Calcutta to Cambridge had been. She wishes Ashok had accepted the position at Northeastern so they could have stayed in the city. She is stunned that in this town there are no sidewalks to speak of, no streetlights, no public transportation, no stores for miles at a time. She has no interest in learning how to drive the new Toyota Corolla it is now necessary for them to own. Though no longer pregnant, she continues at times to mix Rice Krispies and peanuts and onions in a bowl. For being a foreigner, Ashima is beginning to realize is a sort of lifelong pregnancy, a perpetual weight, a constant burden, a continual feeling out of sorts. It is an ongoing responsibility, a parenthesis in what had once been ordinary life, only to discover that previous life has vanished, replaced by something more complicated and demanding. Like pregnancy, being a foreigner, Ashima believes, is something that elicits the same curiosity from strangers, the same combination of pity and respect. Her forays out of the apartment while her husband is at work are limited to the university within which they live and to the historic district that flanks the campus on one edge. She wanders around with Goggle, letting him run across the quadrangle, or sitting with him on rainy days to watch television in the student lounge. Once a week, she makes 30 samosas to sell at the International Coffee House for 25 cents each, next to the Linzer Squares baked by Mrs. Edsold and baklava by Mrs. Kasolis. On Fridays, she takes Goggle to the public library for children's story hour. After he turns 4, she drops him off and fetches him from the university-run nursery school 3 mornings a week. for the hours that Goggle is at nursery school, finger painting and learning the English alphabet, Ashima is despondent, unaccustomed all over again to being on her own. She misses her son's habit of always holding on to the free end of her sari as they walk together. She misses the sound of his sulky, high-pitched little boy voice telling her that he is hungry or tired or needs to go to the bathroom. To avoid being alone at home, she sits in the reading room of the public library in a cracked leather armchair, writing letters to her mother or reading magazines or one of her Bengali books from home. The room is cheerful, filled with light, with a tomato-colored carpet on the floor and people reading the paper around a big, round wooden table with forsythias and cattails arranged at its center. When she misses Goggle especially, she wanders into the children's room. There, pinned to a bulletin board, is a picture of him in profile, sitting cross-legged on a cushion during story hour, listening to the children's librarian, Mrs. Aiken, reading The Cat in the Hat. After 2 years in an overheated university-subsidized apartment, Ashima and Ashok are ready to purchase a home. In the evenings, after dinner, they set out in their car, Goggle in the back seat, to look at houses for sale. They do not look in the historic district where the chairman of Ashok's department lives, in an 18th-century mansion to which he and Ashima and Goggle are invited once a year for Boxing Day tea. Instead, they look on ordinary roads where plastic wading pools and baseball bats are left out on the lawns. Old houses belong to Americans. Shoes are worn inside, trays of cat litter are placed in the kitchens. Dogs bark and jump when Ashima and Ashok ring the bell. They learn the names of the different architectural styles, cape, saltbox, raised ranch, garrison. In the end, they decide on a shingled, two-story colonial in a recently built development, a house previously occupied by no one, erected on a quarter acre of land. This is the small patch of America to which they lay claim. Goggle accompanies his parents to banks, sits waiting as they sign the endless papers. The mortgage is approved, and the move is scheduled for spring. Ashok and Ashima are amazed when moving by U-Haul to the new house to discover how much they possess. Each of them had come to America with a single suitcase, a few weeks' worth of clothes. Now there are enough old issues of the Globe stacked in the corners of the apartment to wrap all their plates and glasses. There are whole years of Time magazine to toss out. The walls of the new house are painted, the driveway sealed with pitch, the shingles and sun deck weatherproofed and stained. Ashok takes photographs of every room, Goggle standing somewhere in the frame to send to relatives in India. There are pictures of Goggle opening up the refrigerator, pretending to talk on the phone. He is a sturdily built child with full cheeks but already pensive features. When he poses for the camera, he has to be coaxed into a smile. The house is 15 minutes from the nearest supermarket, 40 minutes from a mall. The address is 67 Pemberton Road. Their neighbors are the Johnsons, the Mertons, the Aspreys, the Hills. There are 4 modest bedrooms, 1.5 bathrooms, 7-foot ceilings, a 1-car garage. In the living room is a brick fireplace and a bay window overlooking the yard. In the kitchen, there are matching yellow appliances, a Lazy Susan, linoleum made to look like tiles. A watercolor by Ashima's father of a caravan of camels in a desert in Rajasthan is framed at the local print shop and hung on the living room wall. Goggle has a room of his own, a bed with a built-in drawer in its base, metal shelves that hold Tinker Toys, Lincoln Logs, a Viewmaster, and Etch-a-Sketch. Most of Goggle's toys come from yard sales, as does most of the furniture, and the curtains and the toaster and a set of pots and pans. At first, Ashima is reluctant to introduce such items into her home, ashamed at the thought of buying what had originally belonged to strangers, American strangers at that. But Ashok points out that even his chairman shops at yard sales, that in spite of living in a mansion, an American is not above wearing a pair of secondhand pants bought for 50 cents. When they first move into the house, the grounds have yet to be landscaped. No trees grow on the property, no shrubs flank the front door, so that the cement of the foundation is clearly visible to the eye. And so for the first few months, 4-year-old Goggle plays on an uneven, dirt-covered yard
littered with stones and sticks, soiling his sneakers, leaving footprints in his path. It is among his earliest memories. For the rest of his life, he will remember that cold, overcast spring, digging in the dirt, collecting rocks, discovering black and yellow salamanders beneath an overturned slab of slate. He will remember the sounds of the other children in the neighborhood, laughing and pedaling their big wheels down the road. He will remember the warm, bright summer's day when the topsoil was poured from the back of a truck